Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins, Dan Novak, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Jill Robbins.
The South Korean military said that North Korea launched two more missiles Thursday. The new tests make this January the busiest month ever for North Korean missile tests. The report said the North launched what seemed to be two short-distance ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast around 8 a.m. local time. South Korea said the missiles traveled about 190 kilometers at a height of 20 kilometers near Hamhung, a city on North Korea's east coast. So far this month, North Korea has tested missiles six times, firing a total of at least 10 missiles into the sea. Observers say that is the most North Korean missile launches in a single month. The total also includes low-flying cruise missiles. North Korea's intense period of missile tests appears at least partly aimed at pressuring the United States and South Korea. The two countries have called for the North to return to talks on its banned nuclear weapons program. Mark Lambert is U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Japan and Korea. He said Wednesday, the United States will go anywhere and talk about anything with North Korea. We have to have a serious discussion about the denuclearization of North Korea. And if North Korea is willing to do that, all sorts of promising things can happen, Lambert said. North Korea has refused to take part in talks. The country has said the United States should first make changes to its military and economic policies. Leif Erik Easley is an associate professor of international studies at Ewha Women's University in Seoul. He has offered some possible reasons for the tests. Easley said the North Korean government is developing many different offensive weapons despite limited resources and serious economic problems. He added that some of the North Korean tests are part of an effort to develop new abilities, especially for avoiding missile defense systems. Other launches are meant to show that the country is ready to use the missiles it already has, Easley said. Earlier this week, North Korea launched two cruise missiles. It has also carried out two tests of what it described as a hypersonic missile. The North has launched two ballistic missiles from a train and fired two short-distance guided missiles from an airport in Pyongyang. All these tests took place in January. The U.S. State Department on Wednesday condemned the launches. It said they violate several United Nations Security Council resolutions. The State Department also said the launches threaten North Korea's neighbors and the international community. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida called the tests very regrettable. South Korea's National Security Council also expressed strong regret, saying the launches go against peace and stability in the area. Earlier this month, the U.S. increased its restrictions against North Korea. financial restrictions were placed on 5 North Koreans the United States accused of helping to buy supplies for North Korea's weapons programs. I'm Jill Robbins.
Members of the family of Spanish artist Pablo Picasso are selling more than 1,000 digital art pieces of one of his sculptures. The work has never been seen publicly. Picasso's granddaughter, Marina Picasso, and her son, Florian Picasso, showed media some of the art piece in their home in Geneva, Switzerland. They say the digital pieces are a mix of old fine art and digital work. The Picassos want to make money from the recent interest in NFTs, or non-fungible tokens. NFTs are a kind of digital art that gained popularity in 2021. Sales of NFTs have made millions of dollars, but they have been criticized as damaging to the environments and as schemes to make money. But a Picasso artwork would mark a change for NFTs, his family said. NFTs are based on a technology called blockchain, which is also used with digital currencies known as cryptocurrencies. An NFT can be attached to a piece of digital art or other things existing in digital form. The NFT is meant to provide proof that the digital objects are real. While anyone can see the work, the buyer has the official ownership rights. "We're trying to build a bridge between the NFT world and the fine art world," said Florian Picasso, the artist's great-grandson. The artist's family is keeping images of the piece mostly private. They are only showing a small part of the work. It is a ceramic piece the size of a large bowl. The parts that have been shown have a thick yellow line and areas of green. There is also the number 58 at the base. Marina Picasso says the piece is from October 1958, when she was a child. "It's joyful, happy," she said. "It represents life. It's one of those objects that have been part of our life, our intimate lives, my life with my children." Sotheby's is an international company known for selling artworks. It is having an auction in March for the Picasso work, which will include an NFT and the ceramic bowl. An online sale of more than 1,000 other NFTs starts Friday through the Nifty Gateway and Origin Protocol websites. Some of the money from the sales will be donated. Florian Picasso said the family agreed on the colorful ceramic piece because it was a fun one to start. The family and its business managers say the aim is to create a younger community of Picasso fans. Florian Picasso said the NFT honors the artist. "I think it fits within Picasso's legacies because we are paying tribute to him and his way of working, which was always being creative," he said. The NFTs will also come with music mixed by Florian Picasso. He plays music for gatherings as a DJ and is a music producer. He worked with American singer John Legend and rapper Nas. The full song has not been publicly released. Florian played a small part for a reporter, then turned it off. "And to hear more," he said, "you gotta purchase the NFT." I'm Dan Novak.
Citizen Kane, directed by Orson Welles, is widely considered to be one of the best American films of all time. For example, the British Broadcasting Corporation, or BBC, created a list of the best American films. It placed Citizen Kane at the top. In today's program, we will explore the grammar behind one of the most famous lines from Citizen Kane.
You know, Mr. Bernstein, if I hadn't been very rich, I might have been a really great man.
In this report, you will learn about the important expression, you know. You will also learn about past conditional usage and shortened forms of words in everyday speaking. The famous line starts with the words, you know.
You know, Mr. Bernstein.
You know is a common expression that is used in everyday speaking, but it does not necessarily mean what you think it does. For example, you might hear a person ask, "Do you know my name?" Or they might say, "You know my name." This is the literal meaning. However, the line from Citizen Kane uses "you know" in a different way. In this case, it is used to show that you have some kind of connection or shared knowledge with another person. Bernstein is Kane's friend and employee. They know each other well. In this statement, Kane is thinking about his life. He has a sense of loss or sadness in his voice. He is admitting something that he has been thinking about to a person who is close to him. That is why Kane begins his statement with, "you know." This expression has other uses, which you can read about in an earlier everyday grammar story called, "What Do You Know About You Know?" Now let's explore the second part of the line.
If I hadn't been very rich, I might have been a really great man.
This line uses what you might call the past unreal conditional. It involves an if clause, if I hadn't been very rich, and a result clause, I might have been a really great man. The if clause is in the past perfect, and the result clause uses the structure helping verb plus have plus past participle. The helping verb used in the result clause has several possibilities, would, could, and might. The helping verb would expresses a desirable result. The verbs could and might express a possibility. Kane is suggesting that if something had been different in the past, then it might have been possible for him to be different. The past unreal conditional is one of the more complex areas of English grammar because it involves different clauses and uncommon verb structures. But it is interesting for another reason, pronunciation. Did you notice that not all of the words were spoken in the line? Listen again.
If I hadn't been very rich, I might have been a really great man.
Notice that the past unreal statement involves contractions, shortened versions of words. The full version of the statement is this. If I had not been very rich, I might have been a really great man. While this line would be clearly understood, it does not sound natural to an American. Americans often reduce or contract words. Had not becomes hadn't. Also, if you listen closely to Kane, he faintly says have, but he could have also said, I might have been, or even something like this, I might have been. Please note that this last version is used in speaking only, not in writing. The reason Americans reduce helping verbs is because they are function words. Function words have a grammatical purpose, but do not carry much specific meaning. In our example, the reason have is shortened is because native speakers understand which word is being suggested. It is verbs such as might or would that are more important for suggesting additional meaning. That is why you might hear statements such as, "I would have called you," or "I might have been famous." In today's report, we explored the grammar behind a famous line in American film. You learned about an expression, a conditional statement, and how words are shortened in everyday speaking. The next time you watch American films, pay attention to these structures, then use them as much as you can. One day, you might tell a close friend, "You know, I'm glad that I followed everyday grammar. If I hadn't listened to it regularly, I wouldn't have developed such a deep love for English grammar." I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1918, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, a truce took effect between the Allies and Germany. But not until 7 months later was a treaty signed to officially end what was known as the Great War and the war to end all wars. Shirley Griffith and Larry West continue the story of the peace conference following World War I.
American President Woodrow Wilson was one of the chief negotiators at the conference in Paris. Throughout the early months of 1919, he struggled hard for a treaty that would result in peace with justice for all sides. Wilson demanded a treaty that provided for a new international organization. He called it the League of Nations. To Wilson, the League was more important than any other part of the treaty. Not all Americans shared Wilson's opinion. Many feared the League would take away the power of the American government to declare war and make treaties. They also agreed with the leaders of the other Allied nations. Establishing the League was less important than punishing the defeated enemy.
The other major Allied leaders at the peace conference were Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, and Premier Vittorio Otto of Italy. Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Otto understood how much Wilson wanted the League of Nations. They used this knowledge to win Wilson's approval for other parts of the peace treaty. Wilson soon learned that to get the League, he had to compromise on many issues. For example, he had to accept British and French demands to make Germany pay all war damages. The payments added up to more than $300,000 million. Wilson also had to accept the Allied takeover of Germany's colonies.
Some of Wilson's compromises violated his belief in self-determination. This was the right of all people to decide for themselves who would govern them. One compromise, for example, gave to Japan Germany's colonial rights in the Shantung area of China. China protested the decision. It asked that control of Shantung be returned to the Chinese government. But President Wilson needed Japan's support for the League of Nations, so he accepted Japan's demand for control of Shantung. There were other violations of the policy of self-determination. These affected the people and land along the borders of several European nations. For example, 3 million Germans were made citizens of the new nation of Czechoslovakia. Millions of other Germans were forced into the newly formed nation of Poland. And Italy received territory that had belonged to Austria.
Today, most history experts agree Woodrow Wilson was correct in opposing these decisions. They say Germany's loss of territory and citizens caused deep bitterness, and the bitterness helped lead to the rise of fascist dictator Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. In East Asia, Japanese control over parts of China created serious tensions. Both decisions helped plant the seeds for the bloody harvest of World War II, 20 years later. But Allied leaders at the Paris Peace Conference were not looking far into the future. As one person said at the time, they divided Europe like people cutting up a tasty pie.
After months of negotiations, the peace treaty was completed. The Allies gave it to a German delegation on May 7, 1919. The head of the delegation objected immediately. He said the treaty was unfair. He urged his government not to sign it. At first, Germany did not sign. The leader of the government refused and resigned in protest. But a new government was formed, and its leader signed the document at a ceremony at the palace in Versailles outside Paris. Finally, World War I was officially over.
President Woodrow Wilson returned to the United States after the treaty signing ceremony. He was not completely satisfied with the treaty, yet he believed it was still valuable because it established the League of Nations. Wilson's battle for the League was only half over when the treaty was signed in Europe. He had to win approval from the United States Senate. That half of the battle would not be easy.
Part of the problem was political. Wilson was a member of the Democratic Party. The Senate was controlled by the Republican Party. Also, Wilson had refused to name any important Republicans to his negotiating team at the peace conference. Part of the problem was personal. A number of senators disliked Wilson. One was Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Lodge was the powerful chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He told a friend he never expected to hate anyone as much as he hated Wilson.
Wilson spoke before the Senate just 2 days after he returned from Europe. He urged it to approve the peace treaty. Wilson said, "The united power of free nations must put a stop to aggression, and the world must be given peace. Shall we and any other free people refuse to accept this great duty? Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world? We cannot turn back. America shall show the way. The light streams upon the path ahead and nowhere else."
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee began hearings on the treaty. It heard a number of people who opposed the League of Nations. They said the League would destroy the freedom and independence of the United States. The committee completed its hearings and prepared a report for the full Senate. The report said the United States should reject the treaty unless changes were made. The committee proposed almost 40 changes.
The committee's report was a blow to President Wilson, both politically and personally. He had worked extremely hard to win Europe's support for the idea of a League of Nations. Great crowds in Paris had cheered him and his idea. Now, the Senate of his own country was about to reject it. Wilson decided he must take his case out of the hands of the people's representatives. He would take the case directly to the people themselves. He would build public support for the treaty. If enough citizens supported it, he believed, the Senate could not reject it.
President Wilson planned a speaking trip all across the country. His family and his doctor urged him not to go. They said he was still weak from a recent sickness. But Wilson refused the advice. He said the treaty was more important to him than his own life. The president left Washington in early September. He traveled in a special train. In city after city, he made speeches and rode in parades. He shook thousands of hands. At times, he suffered from a painful headache. But there was no time to rest.
Everywhere Wilson stopped, he urged the people to support the League of Nations. It was, he said, the only hope for peace. In Boulder, Colorado, 10,000 people waited to hear him. By then, Wilson was extremely weak. He had to be helped up the steps of the building where he was to speak. He made the speech. He said he was working to honor the men who had died in the war. He said he was working for the children of the world.
Wilson put all his heart and energy into his speeches. And as his family and doctor had warned, the pressure was too great. While in Wichita, Kansas, the pain in his head became terrible. He could not speak clearly. His face seemed frozen. A blood vessel had broken in his brain. Wilson had suffered a stroke. The president was forced to return to Washington. His condition got worse every day. Soon, he was unable to move. Woodrow Wilson would spend the rest of his presidency as a terribly sick man. He continued to hold on to his dreams of a League of Nations, but his dreams now filled a broken body.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.